Just a reminder, the content of this show is for informational purposes only. Please visit blockstack.org/legal/disclaimers for more info. Hi, and welcome to the Stacks Podcast. I'm Zach Valenti. In this episode, we sit down with Preeti Kesareddy, self-taught engineer turned entrepreneur and founder of True Story, and Maniba Lee, CEO of Blockstack PPC. The two discuss Preeti's journey of bringing True Story to life, the regulatory challenges for crypto companies, Blockstack's path to the SEC's approval of its Stacks token, and more. And now, here's Preeti and Maniba.
Hello, everyone. I'm Maniba, co-founder of Blockstack. Really excited to have Preeti here with us on the Stacks podcast. I think most of you should already be familiar with her, but those of you who are not, she's the co-founder and CEO of True Story, which is a very interesting platform for having civil debates online. That's how I look at it, but I'll let her explain more. So for her background, she was an engineer at Coinbase. She did investing at A16Z. And before that, she was actually in finance. So that makes it a very unique background. And I'll let her get into introducing how she got into blockchains and how she ended up starting True Story.
Sure. I think a lot of people probably have heard the story on different podcasts, but I'll say it again. I kind of have an atypical background in the sense that I was an engineer in college, but I didn't end up becoming an engineer outside of college. So in college, I did systems engineering. And then I serendipitously met someone from Goldman Sachs who wanted me to interview there. And long story short, I ended up getting an internship at Goldman Sachs and then eventually a full-time offer at Goldman Sachs. So that was my first foray into the world of finance. And as an engineer, I really had no idea what I was even getting into, because in engineering, you don't learn finance. So, but Goldman did a really good job teaching you on the job what it entails, what does it even mean to have an income statement, balance sheet, et cetera. But I started to realize that my real passion was engineering and it wasn't finance. And I started to be a little bit of a, like, I felt unhappy doing something that I wasn't super passionate about. So I left Goldman and I joined A16Z. And that's when I did investing. And it brought me closer to the engineering side, because like I got to meet with creators every day. I get to understand what they're building. I get to understand why they're building it, some of the technicals behind it. So it was a lot closer to engineering than finance, but you know, I was there for 2 years.
Which year was this when you went to A16Z?
I went to A16Z. So I graduated college in 2012, and then I went to A16Z at the end of 2013.
So this is like the early days of crypto, right? And recent has probably not even made the Coinbase investment yet.
Yeah, so they hadn't made the Coinbase investment, right? That's right. And they probably made it, I think, 6 months after I joined. And one of your questions was, how did I get into blockchain? And it was honestly through that investment that they made that I got a little bit curious. I got a little bit curious because I had no idea at that time what Bitcoin even was. And then I started to do research and learning, et cetera. And that's kind of my first foray into blockchains, but I can go on forever. But that was kind of the first introduction.
So how did you decide to leave Coinbase and start your own company? What was the thinking behind that?
Even before I joined Coinbase, I had this whole year where I spent learning how to code. And a lot of people might know me from that movement where I quit A16Z to learn to code and then I joined Coinbase. The reason I joined Coinbase was that I thought that Coinbase, even today, like it's one of the most trusted brands in cryptocurrency. And I felt like I wanted to be with people around those people so I can learn about the space from them. And while I really got that and I loved the Coinbase team, I learned a lot there. One of the things I started to realize was that Coinbase in the end is a centralized company. It wasn't like built on the blockchain. It's not like truly a decentralized app. So I wasn't really getting the type of experience or knowledge that I really wanted, which is like, I wanted to just like jump deep into crypto. And so I left Coinbase, and that's when I started to just explore, like spent like 6 to 9 months just figuring out what the space was about, learning about Ethereum. I wrote that Ethereum article and then...
Yeah, I was going to bring that up. I came across that article and I was like, wow, this is one of the most like comprehensive analysis of how you would get started on Ethereum. And frankly, I learned a thing or two about Ethereum from your article. Like I was not familiar with some of the inner workings.
Yeah, because I think one of the things that's missing still, even to this day in this space, is lack of documentation and like blog posts, anything, especially two years ago, I felt like there was very little for someone to come, like someone new to figure out. There was not enough knowledge out there for someone new to come into the space and figure out how something works. For example, if you want to learn how Ethereum works, you can go on the website and you can read the white paper. That was the extent of the blog posts that were out there at the time. There's this massive gap between the developers who are coding day to day, who know all the insides, and then the outsiders who just want to get inside, but they don't have the expertise to really merge that gap. So I really wanted to fill that hole. And that's when I wrote that blog post.
So it seems like you wanted to do a deep dive on crypto, more on the protocol level. And then you ended up almost like building a community around crypto.
Yeah.
So what was the thought process around that?
I don't think it was a thought process per se, more so that I was just super passionate about the space. I also innately enjoy educating. I enjoy teaching. I enjoy encouraging people to learn, et cetera. And so because of that innate desire and drive to teach and to mentor, I started to form a community, like you said, of crypto people. And that community ended up being sort of the early True Story community as well.
Yes, we have actually used your platform. I think we did a public review of Casper CBC, and that ended up on your platform. And for me, it was a very refreshing experience, because I'm always hesitant to publicly comment on the technical architecture of some of these things, especially on Twitter, because to me, it seems like a lot of these crypto communities are a little bit like religion, and you can't say anything, even a little bit negative about any particular protocol, because you have these very passionate people who are just going to jump on you. And one thing I noticed on True Story was that the conversation was a lot more civil, right? And it's basically rational arguments. And then there is a little bit of everyone gets a chance that, hey, do you want to refute this point? And then you can actually pull in experts to get almost like a neutral third party viewpoint on some of the topics that are being discussed. And frankly, try to reach a conclusion. Like on Twitter or other places, it's like sometimes it's the person who's the loudest or the person who just won't give up. I have a rule these days. If I find myself responding more than twice to something, it's an indicator that this is going to turn into a debate, and it doesn't just disengage right there.
It bothers me a lot that people have a negative idea of what it means to debate, because it was never meant to be a negative thing. Like debate is the most powerful way to learn and understand and find answers. And so the fact that Twitter has turned debate into almost this evil that no one wants to do is sad. And I think what we're doing on True Story, in fact, the version of True Story you used was our analog version before we shipped.
It was pretty early.
Yeah, it was before we shipped beta. It was on Discourse, but we actually have a real app now. And I think one of the things that we're trying to do is teach people the fact that debate doesn't have to be defeating, or you don't have to get anxiety from having a debate. You don't have to get angry. You can have a civil debate and walk away feeling like you understood something.
Yeah, debates on Twitter are probably, Twitter is the worst medium for it, right? The way it works is you get a notification that someone just said something about you that is extremely negative, and now there are these 50 people who are liking that thing, waiting for your response, right? So it's almost like addiction. They're trying to kind of monetize your attention in a way. And they really want you to engage right there and then.
Yeah.
Versus a debate where you're intellectually curious and you're entering the debate with the intention of learning something. It's not like you don't have this time pressure or this idea that so many people are watching you, and you don't have even enough space to express yourself, right? It's a weird Twitter threads that go off.
Yeah, no, exactly. And you hit on two things. One is the format. Obviously, Twitter was meant, it was built for broadcast, right? It was built to broadcast some piece of news or information. It was not meant for conversation. And I think people naturally try to use it for that, but I don't think it really does a good job of enabling conversation. But secondly, the more important thing is the intent. I think you're spot on there in the sense that people don't come on Twitter with an intent to seek to learn the other side. You know, they come with an intent to promote. And that's what Twitter is really good for. And I think that's true of any product, right? Like when you sign on to a product, there's certain intent that you're going into that product with. And with True Story, the intent is like you're intending to go in to debate because you want to learn, you want to understand the other side. And so that intent makes a huge difference for sure.
So I sometimes feel like the crypto is still in the Wild West kind of an era. Yeah. And there is like so much misinformation out there. Like if you compare this to more traditional fields like cloud computing that I used to work in, there's more well-established technical conferences and peer review processes that people are used to. And I think the players are just more sophisticated, but you can't blame people here because the kind of financial incentives that are at play here in crypto, they're not found anywhere else, right? So it's kind of a unique situation. So we can't say, oh, this is how traditionally engineering or computer science works and everyone should try to make it that way. I think we need to embrace the fact that crypto is just different. Yeah. But still, part of me wishes that there were those more structured peer review kind processes in place in crypto. And to me, it seems like what you're doing with True Story is kind of like a crypto native take on something like that.
Yeah, exactly. And I think you make an interesting point in the like, we can't expect crypto to be like these other industries purely because there's money tied into it. The incentives here are different. But I agree that we still need to have, there's so many unanswered questions in this space. And we definitely need a medium and a place to like debate and understand like what we do know and what we don't know. And I don't think Twitter is going to serve as that tool. So our goal definitely is to build a platform that does serve that tool.
Interesting. So I think my team was doing some research before this podcast, and they handed me notes saying that you got caught up in an ICO scandal. I was like, wait, what? Is that real? Like, or did it actually happen?
Yeah. So, I mean, when I was exploring and early in the crypto space, I, just like everyone else, you know, I had rose-colored glasses and like everything looked shiny. It was like so cool. So I ended up jumping into a project, not knowing much about it, but it just sounded like it was going to change the world. This was going to be the thing. And then 2 months later, I had to leave because I realized that like the project wasn't going to work out. They didn't even meet their min cap requirements for the ICO. And so they didn't know how they're going to get funding for the project. It was a huge shocker for me because it was the first time where I entered I took on a role and it was like catastrophic. Whereas like my previous two roles were very like prestigious, right? I worked at Goldman, I worked at A16Z, Coinbase, and then I jumped into this project where it just like failed. It was hard. It was not easy for sure.
And did that somehow play a role in the True Story as well, or just like a separate?
Yeah, it definitely did. Like one of the things I started to notice was the way I got information in crypto in the early days was I had to basically crowdsource it from my friends. So I had a close network of people that I considered experts in the crypto space, and I kind of crowdsourced my information. Is this a good project? Is this a trustable thing, etc.? And I realized that like that's how most people are starting to get their information in crypto too. It's a lot of like crowdsourced knowledge, and I thought that was a very powerful way to get to knowledge. And I was like, can you build a tool where anyone who has a question can post it, and then now they can crowdsource that answer specifically for crypto? And that's kind of the origin of True Story, where we were trying to do claim validation. Instead of a question, it was more around like someone would make a claim and then the crowd would validate that claim. And so we did put that product out. And one of the things we started to notice was people were not just focusing on like objective claims that had a right or wrong answer, but they were using it as a tool to get to answers that are somewhat more subjective as well. And again, this comes back to the thing we were saying earlier of like, there's a lot of unanswered questions in this space and in the world at large. Like there's so many questions that people have been thinking about for years, but there's no medium to talk about it. And so they were using True Story as a way to like debate these almost open-ended questions. And we realized like that's a much more powerful medium than purely like trying to validate like objective claims. So that's when we pivoted over to debate.
Is it even a big pivot? Like to me, they seem like very related. It's a slight different spin on kind of like the same thing, right?
From a back-end product point of view, to be honest, it's not like a huge change, but it's more from a perception of what you're coming into the platform for. You are still learning truths, but it's not like there's one objective truth for every claim. It's more that you're coming in to understand and hear the different sides.
Got it. So this is more like what you're focusing on now and what people's expectations are when they're using the product.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think it's very interesting that you notice kind of like the similar things in crypto, where it's like the Wild West or there's misinformation out there, and you went down the route of creating true story. On the other hand, like me and people at Blockstack, we obviously noticed similar problems. We operate in the same space. And our response was more like, why don't we work with the regulators and try to have the traditional checks and balances in place that pretty much exist in public markets.
Yeah.
If you look at the US securities markets, like they've been around for decades now, such a stable environment, and companies are almost like required to disclose facts about themselves, and like audited financials, risk factors, other disclosures, like anything that is material. Mm-hmm. And we thought that that could actually be a good thing for crypto, which is a little bit of a contrarian stance, right? Like on one side, you're saying we stand for decentralization. And at the same time, you're arguing that this type of regulation can be good for the industry. So I was very curious like how the industry would perceive our approach.
Yeah.
But I've been very pleased with the response. I think most people are very supportive that we went ahead and worked with the regulators to come up with a framework that works better for crypto assets while maintaining the decentralization properties of the underlying network. But I can almost like see the shared pain point that we're trying to address. Like in our case, anything that we list in our offering circular, we have to back it with data. Otherwise, you know, the regulators can hold us accountable.
Yeah, no, that's super interesting. I think basically what we're trying to do is take the wild, wild west and add a little bit of rationality and rules to it. But then one could argue that's antithetical to decentralization. So it'll be interesting to watch how this whole thing plays out. I'm very curious to see also with the regulation side, you know, are they really going to be friendly to this, or is this just like, I don't know, I'm curious.
Well, the SEC qualified the offering, right? First ours and then you now as well.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of pressure on them. A lot of people thought that the regulators are never going to approve anything. And the fact that now both Blockstack and you now is qualified, I believe like if I was looking at the rest of the ecosystem, I think the next big major step would be regulated security exchanges. Like if they also get through the door. For exchanges, they also require coordination with FINRA. So from the SEC side, it's a passive approval, but FINRA actually gives out a license and you need both. Mm-hmm. I think that would be the next major step for the industry.
And so is that, I'm curious, like from Blockstack's point of view, assuming the token sale goes well, are you hoping to be sort of the poster child for setting the right way to do these token sales? Like what was your motivation behind this?
I think most of it was because we wanted to open up the network to the US markets. Like we are based out of here and we think that the US markets are very important. Not just from a capital perspective, but imagine there are so many companies in Silicon Valley. Let's say they want to build on top of Blockstack. And as part of building on our network, they need to hold the Stacks tokens on their balance sheet. Like no serious company is ever going to keep an asset on their balance sheets that they think might be illegal in the jurisdiction, right? So for us, it was about opening up the network in a fully regulated manner to the US markets, because the other option, and a lot of projects take that option, is to just block US investors and try to go outside. That's one thing. I think part of the intention is also that this can help other projects. Like there are, especially in my conversations, people who are operating like more sophisticated companies, and they're kind of like curious about token offerings. They get really scared by this Wild West kind of behavior. And a regulated path for them to enter the industry is actually much easier. I do think that it is possible that a bunch of other projects will start following kind of like the same framework. And especially like as the cost of doing these things goes down. Sure, we took a bigger hit on the kind of like the cost around the legal analysis and accounting and other things, but it was also, we were doing the analysis for the first time with our securities lawyers. Other people don't have to do it again and again. So a bunch of like pretty important questions were being considered in our qualification. Things like, you know, are miners broker dealers, or stuff like, what does paths to decentralization look like?
Yeah.
At what point you no longer need to comply with US securities regulations? If you're familiar with what the SEC did with Ethereum, mm-hmm. they effectively did not comment on how Ethereum started or how Ethereum reached a stage where they think it is no longer a security.
Yep.
But they did say that if you just look at the Ethereum ecosystem right now, Ethereum is not a security. So in a way, like, Ethereum is getting grandfathered in, that we're going to ignore how it launched and we're going to ignore how it reached this state. But if you just look at where it is today, it's not a security.
Yep.
And the work that we have done, I believe, is actually harder, because we are defining how you can launch and how you can go through this path of decentralization to reach a stage where even in the US, you're no longer considered a security. Internationally, interestingly, it's actually very different, because in most of the jurisdictions that we have looked at, the Stax token is already considered a utility.
Interesting.
And it's not considered a security.
So, like, one, you bring up a good point about the US thing. Being an entrepreneur, especially a crypto entrepreneur in the US, is definitely... It's hard, because, like, the regulations are not friendly. No one's really has set the path for what the right way to do anything is. So I think if you and the Blockstack team can pull this off, like, I think that'd be a massive win for a lot of crypto entrepreneurs in the US. I'll say that myself too. But I think, like, some of the interesting questions that they'll come up are, like, you know, I think one of the things that one of the True Story community members noticed, it was that the Blockstack token, for example, we almost need to reinvent accounting principles to account for what these token sales represent, because I think it's represented as revenue in your case, but is that really revenue, or is that a new line item on the balance sheet that we should think about with crypto projects?
Yeah. So I think this question came up with how we were doing accounting.
Yeah.
And accounting is different for different purposes. Like, for tax purposes, you could actually recognize it as one thing. For your financial statements, you might actually, you know, take a, depending on, like, how it's being used, the treatment might be different. So given that we knew that we were working on something very hard, we would always take the worst case scenario in every type of treatment, right? So we are willing to pay the highest amount of taxes, right? And we are willing to treat it as, like, whatever is the same with our crypto holdings. Like, we would treat them fully discounted, that, hey, I'm going to take the value of this crypto at the lowest prices, right? So imagine us being extremely careful. And that's one of the reasons why we ended up with the treatment that we did. And it's possible that other projects down the road could try to come up with a different accounting treatment, which might be a harder battle, right? Because your tax IRS stuff gets involved, that should you be paying taxes? Like, I mean, you can try and make a case that I shouldn't be paying taxes on the money raised through a token offering, because it's similar to capital, but then you end up into all sorts of weird scenarios that you're also not giving up equity, right? So this is not traditional capital raise. So by paying revenue on it, at least we are taking a clear stance that this is not a security in that sense. Although there are other criteria that the SEC uses, through which we are basically saying that due to an abundance of caution, we will treat it as if it's a security for a short time, mm-hmm. right? Until it's clear to everyone that the token is not a security.
And so when you were considering going the SEC route, were there any other alternatives you're considering, or did you know sort of?
Yeah, I can walk you through this. It's very interesting. So I think the alternatives, if you think about it, are ban the US investors, go abroad, right? And I already discussed how, for us, like, it didn't make sense, because we wanted to open up our network to all the users in the US, all the companies we want to build on top. Like, imagine if you're a developer in the US. So now we have around, I think, 170 independent teams or startups that are building on top.
Yep.
Imagine if you had to, like, ban all the US ones. That would be a pretty, pretty horrible situation. The second option was that you go ahead and you just do the offering and then brace up for basically taking the SEC to court, which a bunch of other projects are now in a situation. I know I'm an entrepreneur and I like taking risks, but that's a type of risk that I'm not willing to take. And I do think that the thing that convinced me was the more I looked into the securities regulations, it basically at some point the aha moment was that the technology can adapt to regulations faster than regulations can adopt the technology. And once I was convinced there, I would go have conversations with securities lawyers or even the SEC. And if they would point out something that that's a problem, I would go and tweak the protocol so that it's no longer a problem. And that's actually much faster to do than waiting for. So another option would have been that we just wait for a new law to be introduced, right? Which I think is, again, you're just like sitting and waiting and you're not actively trying to do something. And who knows how long it would actually take for Congress to introduce something new.
Yeah. So then like, I know that with Blockstack, because you had raised some capital, you had a little bit of runway to be able to do this. But like, what about all the crypto startups who may not have as much capital?
Absolutely. Right. So I think we went for a regulation A+, which has a limitation of 50 million maximum capital that can be raised. Mm-hmm. And it also has requirements like 2 years of audited financials. So people should look at the framework that we used for some company that is at least at a Series B stage startup from a traditional venture capital perspective, mm-hmm. right? It is not for doing your seed round. If you want to do your equivalent of a seed round as a token offering, I think there are other frameworks like RegCF that have lower limits on the amount of capital raised, but they are cheaper as well, right? Okay. I think like the way I kind of like look at all these different frameworks, imagine, you know, going back to the 80s or early 90s, yep. where people were coming up with the typical Series A round or a typical Series B round. And interestingly, like some of the decisions that got made like back then, we still live with them, right? Like look at the 4-year vesting that people have.
Yeah.
The reason why we have 4-year vesting is because companies would do their IPO in 4 years. Right? So it's like that historic thing that everyone does, but not a lot of people realize why we even do it.
Yeah.
And what we are doing over here is kind of like setting those frameworks for this new type of startups that are being formed. And a lot of people are facing similar challenges. It's not just the legal framework. Like think about employee retention. So we had to come up with frameworks around how to do token grants. And initially, like when, let's say the network is not developed, then the value of token is very low. How do you grant tokens then? That's equivalent to how founders kind of like pay upfront for their common stock in a startup, right? So we did something similar where people are paying upfront. And then when the network is developed and there's a market for tokens and they're more valued, then you have to look into tax optimizations or the equivalent of stock options for tokens. Yep. So imagine like all those type of different instruments are also being developed internally here, which is a great like hiring tactic for us. We can go to the best people and tell them that we would get to work on these cutting edge things, like even in the legal and finance department, not just on the engineering side.
Yeah. And so now that you've worked with the SEC, are you more optimistic about the regulatory scenario in the US, or would you still say it's better to go build crypto projects elsewhere?
I'm extremely optimistic now. And it's like, I think a big shout out to the staff at the SEC. Like yeah. they realized how big of a deal this was for our industry. They were willing to get on phone calls with us, do rounds of comments over email versus the typical submission process and their normal kind of like process that they follow. And they tried to rush this out as quickly as they possibly could. I know that to the outside world, even 10 months might seem like a long time. But for the SEC, where the securities regulations have been around since 1933,
yeah.
and they're trying to get a new type of an asset out. And imagine like how many different questions there are that is this an investment contract? Is this equity? Is it debt? All sorts of concerns around ATS or broker dealers. And some of the issues that we were doing legal analysis for, they can potentially set precedents for other products, right? And you consider all of that, 10 months actually doesn't sound like a lot of time.
It's not. Yeah, it's not that big of a deal. Especially, I mean, even like ICOs spent like a year marketing their projects. So it's not that. I think like with crypto projects, yeah, like 10 months is nothing. I'm really curious to see how it plays out. Like, cause like what I struggle with is like how to get the SEC comfortable with the fact that unlike public company stock, where it's a lot more liquid, right? Like you can see the financial statement, you can see the revenue, you can see the profits, so you can see how that stock that they're selling in the IPO is liquid. With crypto projects, the liquidity comes like way later in the network's life cycle. So convincing the SEC of like allowing that the retail investors to hold those almost like illiquid, uncertain tokens, like how do you get them comfortable on that?
Yeah, so I think it was a lot of work on the risk factor side.
Yeah.
If you go and read our SEC offering circular, it's almost like a quote-unquote mini IPO filing.
Yeah.
And the section that is most comprehensive is the risk factors section. And people, like we tried our best to scare off as many people as we can, giving them all the proper disclosures and risk factors.
Yeah.
And the understanding really is that you should read all this information if you're trying to participate in something that is high risk investment.
Yeah.
And in terms of the liquidity, I was going to comment that I think, and this is, I know we have a live offering, so I have to be very careful with my comments. So this is just my opinion that the next big step for the industry is going to be regulated security exchanges that come into play.
Yep.
Because once you have that part of the ecosystem there, then it actually becomes very straightforward for projects that this is a path that I need to follow. And once I get qualified in terms of liquidity, there are these exchanges available, right? And for exchanges, it makes their job a little bit easier, because projects are almost like asked to disclose all this information during their filing. So it makes it easier for the exchanges to do their due diligence as well.
Mm.
And I think it will reduce the noise in the space, because a lot of the unsophisticated players or obvious scams just won't be able to get through the door, right? And then in some ways, exchanges would have to do less work.
Yeah.
Because they're already getting a filtered list of real projects that can even get listed.
So you mean like a more regulated version of an IEO?
Yeah, I mean, IEO was another strange concept where it's so interesting. Like sometimes exchanges would call us and they would be interested in, hey guys, like, are you interested in listing? And we'll explain to them that no, we are actually working with US regulators and we don't want any exchanges to complicate that situation. So we don't want to engage right now. And then they would ask like some other questions, especially around these IEOs. And interestingly, would themselves say, given how compliant you guys are trying to be, you are not a good fit for an IEO.
Yeah. Exactly.
Which is like funny, right? Like that means that something is happening out there in the market that doesn't make sense. It's almost like every IEO is like a pop on day one and there's a rush. And we're almost the opposite of that. We are telling people, the sale is open for 60 days. Do your diligence, right? If you have an allocation, you pre-registered, we will honor it and mm-hmm. things like that. So try to calm down people that they should actually do their research and understand all the risk factors instead of like creating this FOMO that, hey, if you don't do this right now, you might miss out on some financial opportunity.
Yeah, and I really like that. And I think if done right, these types of token offerings are like opening up the door for retail investors who never had access to this type of investing. And I think like if the SEC and the projects like collaborate together to do ethical token sales, I think that opens up it opens up investing to a whole new group of people who never would have been able to invest before.
That's the biggest thing. Think of it this way, that the first 100,000 users of Facebook just used a free product and told all their friends about it, but they never had any financial upside in the success of Facebook. The financial upside was completely limited to all the Silicon Valley insiders. Whereas with a decentralized system and a crypto asset like this, the early users can also have a potential financial upside. And that's the thing you're talking about. And I think it's extremely interesting. I think Balaji says that startups used to start on Sand Hill Road and end up on Wall Street. And crypto is actually changing both of those things. Like you no longer need to start on Sand Hill Road and you no longer need to end up on Wall Street. I think we are experiencing that right now. And that's what it makes crypto so interesting. Speaking of Facebook, actually, what do you think of the recent headlines that are coming out that Facebook is potentially installing these quote-unquote backdoors in WhatsApp. Some people are defending that, no, they're just sending encrypted data back to their servers. But like, where's the line?
Yeah, I mean, I think like fundamentally, Facebook, it's not new, right? They've been doing this for about a decade almost. But I think people started to get smarter only very recently. And all of a sudden, it's this big deal that they have all this data and they do all these privacy invasion tactics, et cetera. But obviously, I don't think it's good. Obviously, I think that people, especially now, are starting to care about that. And I don't think they can keep pulling that off. But I think it's going to take a long time before Facebook's culture internally changes to care about privacy, because their whole business is built around user data. So to completely change that, it's not an overnight thing. It's a massive like shift in how they do everything.
Yes. And Mark Zuckerberg, like, you know how every year he takes up a new challenge?
Yeah.
So for this year, he said he's going to focus on user privacy. And I frankly thought that maybe that this is a good thing and maybe they're actually getting serious.
Yeah.
And I've been publicly supporting efforts like Facebook Libra, that team. And again, I think that team is separate from Facebook. So yeah, it's still possible that that team has good intentions and they want to do the right thing. But the parent company is just shooting themselves in the foot. Why would you do this at such a critical time when people are almost like willing to give you a chance that maybe you are now getting serious about privacy?
I mean, to be honest, like even like some of the key people left, like Alex Damos left. I mean, they had a lot of key people, Instagram founders left. And I think I even had friends internally that worked at Facebook that left because of the same reasons. They just felt it was somewhat unethical, some of the stuff that they were doing. But it's a culture thing. Like I don't think culture can change overnight or even in 1 year. That's like, if your culture and entire business is built on that, that's, I struggle to understand how they'll kind of meet the future, which I think is open and decentralized. So Libra attempts to do that. It attempts to kind of solve the innovator's dilemma by building this new privacy-focused cryptocurrency. But what my question around Libra is, there has to be some motivation for Facebook to do this. People don't do stuff for fun or free.
Yeah.
It has to be some incentive to do it. So what is that incentive? Is it truly to build a global currency, or is there some alternative incentive that we don't know about?
And it was amazing to see the backlash from Congress and the government, because they saw this as Facebook is now, I think there's already a little bit of a tension going on where I've been involved with some conversations with lawmakers where they want to have antitrust actions against both Google and Facebook. And interestingly, it's not just Facebook. I think Facebook has a worse image generally, like broadly speaking. But internally at the US government, I'm actually noticing more hostility towards Google than Facebook. Like Facebook is now like number two. And that was a little bit surprising to me, that why is Google kind of like the number one company? But they're very serious about antitrust.
Yeah.
And at the same time, when Facebook comes up and says that we're completely going to bypass a lot of these like regulations that may apply and just start a new global reserve currency, I think people are going to freak out. And that's what we saw with all the hearings that were going on. And interestingly, I think I never thought I would say this, but Microsoft is better positioned to deal with a lot of these things than Facebook or Google.
Because why do you say that?
Because, so this is what happened, right? Microsoft was the king of the desktop era, like before cloud computing. And it basically had a monopoly over there. And then when cloud computing happened, the business model shift. And I think Fred Wilson says this, that shifts in business models are actually more disruptive than shifts in technology, right? So what happened over there was products became free. Google has never charged a software license to anyone, right? All the products are free,
yeah,
and they're monetizing user data. So Google and Facebook are two companies who are basically the native cloud computing companies, and their business model is, let's just get as much user data about a particular person as possible. That's their bread and butter. And Microsoft struggled to kind of like fight that, and they tried so hard to enter this business, and they never could. Right. So Microsoft is actually not sitting on a lot of user data at all. And now when the world is now about to move away from this business model and there's a lot of heat on these big tech companies, Microsoft can come across as, look, we care about user privacy. They're already kind of like pivoting into this open source company and acquired GitHub, which is again, a funny thing that I think 2 days ago, this came out that GitHub is now banning developers from certain countries. I'm pretty sure Microsoft like had no option there. They were pretty much asked by the governments to comply. But that is again such a big use case for decentralized systems that you and I are working on.
That's an interesting thing. I hadn't thought about Microsoft being in a better position to do this. From a business model perspective, I can totally see what you mean. Because again, I come back like to Facebook and Google, it's like they don't use user data. They don't have a business.
Yep.
And it's like Libra is antithetical to Facebook. It cannot be any more opposite. But I'm curious to see how it goes. And I think one other interesting thing that I heard that happened during Congress was they specifically, I think, said they didn't want it to be a public utility, or that was not the intention, which is interesting because like if that's not the case, then you can't really claim that it's going to be this global reserve currency.
Right. I think there are very interesting questions over there, because under some lens, even the securities regulations kick in.
Yep.
Because you're starting a reserve and you're giving people a piece of that reserve. It starts to look like a security. I'm not a securities lawyer. I usually just tell people that go talk to a securities lawyer for the actual analysis there. But I think there are many, many potential issues. So speaking of decentralization, how decentralized is TrueStory right now, or what are your plans in terms of, I believe you're implemented on top of Cosmos right now,
but I'd love to learn
more.
Yeah. So we built the backend on Cosmos SDK, and Cosmos, what it gives you in a nutshell is the tool set to build decentralized applications. We can build our own application specific blockchain, and I think Blockstack is also similar in that regard, right? So yeah, we've built on Cosmos, and right now we only have one node running because everything is in beta. We're on testnet, we're invite only, et cetera. But when we feel like we're ready to open it up and go on main network and actually have it be open to the public, then at any point in time, we can run and many, many nodes and have other people also run many nodes of TrueStory so that it slowly decentralizes over time. But yeah, right now it's just one node.
So how does like mining work? Is there a cryptocurrency involved?
The actual app has an in-app currency, and that same currency can be used for also validating transactions on the back end. So it's just a proof of stake Tendermint system. You know of Tendermint, right? So it's a Tendermint blockchain, and the consensus is the same thing as Tendermint. And
I think their approach is a little bit different, because from what I can understand, they're helping people with the SDKs to start their own blockchains.
Yeah.
And then they are working on kind of like interconnecting the different blockchains.
Yeah.
Whereas for us, it's like, here's the Stacks blockchain that gives developers the tools for basically building their apps on the Stacks blockchain for the most part. But if some app really needs the scalability of, let's say their transactions are just becoming too much for the underlying main chain, then we have the concept of an app chain, where you're logically on top of the Stacks blockchain. Whereas this seems more like a disconnected blockchains that are interconnected through their software and protocol.
Yeah, they have that's right. So they have many, many blockchains, and then they connect these many blockchains using something called IBC, which is their interoperability protocol.
Cool. I'm getting notifications that we have 5 minutes to wrap up. And before we wrap up, I wanted to invite you live so that you can't say no to our conference in San Francisco. It's going to be in October, and we have Neil Stephenson. I don't know if you're a fan of Snow Crash.
I am.
So Neil Stephenson is going to open up the conference with Naval Ravikant.
Wow, awesome.
That's the keynote. And then we already got Dave Morin, as he's the founder of Bath and Slow Ventures, advisor to Blockstack as well. And other speakers like Elizabeth Stark from Lightning. So we wanted to drop this live invite
on you. Of course, I'd love to join.
Awesome. So I think
is it all virtual or is it?
No. It's our flagship event. Happens every year. So it's the Blockstack annual conference. I think it's the fourth in the series now. Last year was in Berlin, where the keynote was Edward Snowden.
Oh, wow.
So he was speaking over a video, and that was pretty cool. But some people are actually more excited about Neil Stephenson than Edward Snowden. There are a lot of engineers who basically grew up like reading all of his different novels, me included. My PhD thesis, chapter one, has a quote from Snow Crash. Like that's how it all starts.
That's awesome. Cool. Well, I'm excited for that. Thanks for having me on, Muneeb.
Absolutely. This was great. And I think we'll follow up with your invite to our summit, and hope to see you there.
Awesome. I'm looking forward to it. Have a good week.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Bye.
This has been the Stacks Podcast. To learn more about True Story, visit truestory.io. You can follow Preethi on Twitter at @IM_Preethi. Muneeb Ali is at Muneeb, and I'm at Zach Valenti. If you like this episode, please consider leaving a rating or review for the show wherever you listen to podcasts. To learn more about building decentralized apps, please visit blockstack.org. The music in this episode is by Andrew Apple Pie. Check out andrewapplepie.com for more. Until next time, thank you for listening.